Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Trinitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Update on the Treatment of Liver Cancer. It's a very important workshop that we're offering today. I know many of you have really asked us to offer this workshop, and we're offering it today, and we're delighted with all of you on the call today. This is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and really because of that collaboration, we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have over 429 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States, from all different regions of the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, India, Nepal, and the United Kingdom, so you truly come from all over the world. And I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that our speakers will be following, and there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations, really as additional resources for you. They're free resources for you to get additional help and information. In addition, there is an evaluation form. And I would ask all of you to please, at the end of the workshop today, complete that evaluation form. We very much depend upon your feedback on what you think of the program and the topics that you would like us to do in the future to really guide us as we develop more programs. And this is 2012, the beginning of the year, and we're planning many programs for this year. And your recommendations could not come at a better time. So please do fill out the evaluations, tell us what you think of the program and the topics you'd like us to offer going forward. Now, today's program was made possible by a charitable contribution from Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals and Onyx Pharmaceuticals, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. We have wonderful speakers on the program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Al Benson, the third. Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director for Clinical Investigations, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. Dr. Benson is going to start off and present an overview of liver cancer, current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. And to begin, I'd like to just briefly give you a little bit of an overview of liver cancer. First of all, worldwide, this is a very important health problem, particularly in developing nations, including throughout Africa, as well as in other populations of individuals, such as individuals who live throughout Asia. In North America, including the United States, the development of hepatocellular cancer is less common, but remains an important healthcare issue, particularly for those at risk. When we look at risk factors for hepatocellular carcinoma, what dominates is the risk for people who have liver cirrhosis of any cause. The most common causes for liver cirrhosis in the United States include previous infection with hepatitis, as well as those who have had excessive alcohol consumption. One of the challenges that we face in taking care of people with hepatocellular carcinoma is that, in fact, we have to address two different diseases at once. For example, I said what was an important risk factor was the fact that most of our patients have liver cirrhosis. So with injury to the liver, this can result in important management issues to control the effects of liver cirrhosis, including abnormal liver function. Abnormal liver function is an important factor because it can sometimes limit the type of choices we have for treatment. Then, of course, the second disease is the actual cancer itself. In terms of how we evaluate people, there are actually a number of different staging systems that people utilize. Just so you've heard the names, more typically we will use what's referred to as Child Pugh classification or the Barcelona Clinic Liver Cancer Staging System. But there are more than that. And I think what is important in the consideration of staging, we have to take into account not only the anatomy of the liver and where tumors might be located, but we also have to think about the overall functional status of the individual person as well as the function of liver, of the liver itself. So when we look at various factors to make treatment decisions, we look at the tumor staging, such as the number and size of liver nodules or tumors that may have developed, whether there's major invasion of important blood vessels, and whether the cancer has spread outside the liver to other locations, which can include, for example, lymph nodes. It can include spread to the lungs or even bones. I already mentioned also looking at the liver function, which we typically measure by routine blood tests. And then another important factor is what we call performance status. And what that means is how well is a person functioning? How well are they getting along during the day? Are they very active? Are they eating well? Or are they losing weight, very fatigued, and perhaps confined to bed, which can have profound implications in terms of what our treatment options might be. When we think about treatment, there are actually a host of different issues and a number of different possibilities. So although because of the background liver cirrhosis, we have limitations, there are people who may actually be able to have surgery and have, for example, a small liver cancer surgically removed. This decision really requires a multidisciplinary approach, so we want to make sure that our hepatology physicians, that our surgeons and medical oncologists, for example, and radiologists are participating in these discussions to make that decision. There are also individuals who may be appropriately managed with liver transplantation, and that decision also requires a multidisciplinary approach at expert centers where an individual person can be carefully evaluated for this potential curative option. We also have opportunities to treat the liver with other methods of therapy, which we in general refer to as liver-directed therapies, but there are actually a host of different approaches that range. For example, there are select individuals who might receive what's called radiofrequency ablation or heat therapy to the tumor, or individuals may be able to have what's referred to as chemoembolization, which is a combination therapy approach administered by what amounts to an IV catheter that enters the liver circulation and allows us to treat at least portions of the liver at any one time. And there are also some newer approaches such as radioembolization, where we actually use very small radioactive microspheres and inject those via a catheter to tumor areas. In addition, we've entered a new era of treatment, that really for the first time we have what's referred to as systemic therapies to offer people. The most frequently considered systemic therapy is actually not a chemotherapy drug, but one that we refer to as a targeted or biological therapy, referred to as sorafenib. And there have been, for example, two very important trials, one principally including patients in the Western world, including throughout Europe, as well as another trial evaluating patients throughout Asia, where the utilization of sorafenib has shown benefit for individual patients. In terms of some of the new treatment approaches that we are considering, first of all, when we have therapies that we have already been using, such as people who may be appropriate to have a liver surgery, or individuals who may be appropriate for a liver-directed therapy, such as chemoembolization, we start thinking about combining such approaches with a drug like sorafenib. And that's currently what's going on in terms of clinical trials, and Dr. Abu Alfa will address some of this in more detail. He will also mention that there are some other new drugs, mostly biologics, that are under assessment. But it's quite promising that we have been able to make some progress in therapeutic development, and now we're moving ahead, looking at not only combinations of treatment approaches and new drugs, but very importantly, we need to understand more about the biology of primary liver cancer, because if we understand, for example, biologic pathways that can encourage cancer cell growth, it allows us to look at different treatment approaches that may result in developing a treatment that will actually target a certain biological feature within the tumor. And I think many of us believe that is our best hope of moving forward with additional treatment strategies for this disease. Dr. Abu Alfa will talk also about symptom management, but when we evaluate people for treatment, whether it's a new therapy such as on a clinical trial or one of the therapies we are routinely using, we need to pay attention to patients' symptoms and to certainly keep people comfortable and best able to actually receive a therapy. In terms of communicating with your healthcare team, I already mentioned that the treatment of primary liver cancer often is a multidisciplinary approach involving a number of different physicians. So this could include specialists in liver diseases referred to as hepatologists. It could include liver transplant surgeons or other cancer surgeons that are involved, for example, in surgical removal of a tumor. It could involve interventional radiologists who often are the physicians who actually administer liver-directed therapy, such as radiofrequency ablation, chemoembolization, or radioembolization. It certainly can include people such as Dr. Abu Alfa and myself, who are medical oncologists, who are often the people who are not only helping to coordinate people's care, but administering the so-called systemic therapy, such as sorafenib. Also, other radiologists helping us interpret x-rays, and in many cases, the pathologist is involved. So an individual patient and their families may actually come across multiple different individuals in the healthcare team, and that also includes, importantly, people who help manage symptoms, including oncology nurses, for example. And all of these individuals need to be on the same page in terms of how well a patient is doing. So it is important for the individual person to let the clinical team know exactly what medications are being used. And these even include over-the-counter medicines like Tylenol, aspirin, vitamins, herbal products. All of that is critically important, as well as giving the team an understanding of how well the person is really doing, how well the person is getting along, and certainly during the course of therapy, reporting any type of change, including potential side effects, because many of our treatments will have side effects, and we sometimes have to make adjustments in the treatment strategy. So understanding side effects is really critically important and must be promptly reported to the healthcare team. I realize that that was a very, very quick review, but I think it will set the stage for the additional information you'll be hearing over the next few minutes. Thank you, Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Benson, for just really a very comprehensive overview and really studying the stage and really identifying all the different treatment approaches. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Ghazan Abu-Alfa, and Dr. Abu-Alfa is Assistant Attending Physician, Gastrointestinal Oncology Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He's also Assistant Professor at Weill Medical College at Cornell University. And Dr. Abu-Alfa is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, controlling symptoms and pain, and quality of life concerns. Dr. Abu-Alfa?
Thanks. Thank you so much, Dr. Messner, and thanks, Dr. Benson, for the important introduction to what I'm going to follow with. And if anything, I can tell you my story. I've been involved with liver cancer for almost 12 years now, and when I joined Sloan Kettering, and my boss told me to take care of liver cancer, I have to admit there was not much to be done. And now I'm very, very busy, like many others. And this is the good news for all of us being patients and physicians. And I would say that I have a rather optimistic view about advancement of the therapy for HCC, or primary liver cancer. So as Dr. Benson mentioned, no question that the platform changed when sorafenib became or was declared as a standard of care, as it was noted in two clinical trials, as he previously said. Obviously, despite that we have seen on those two trials that there was an improvement in survival, in other words, patients are living longer, and I think this is all what we want for patients all the time, is to live longer and do well. Obviously, the sky is the limit, and everybody felt that we would like to push that limit further and try to provide an improvement in survival beyond even what sorafenib could have provided on its own. For that reason, there has been many different approaches in how to do that. Some of them are quite simple, or they might sound simple, which is, what if another drug would do the same job or better? And there has been trials of that kind. Other trials try to see if we combine the sorafenib with some other medications or combine different medications together, would we also move beyond the median survival that already was reported? Thirdly, some people thought if we already know what patients can do when they get sorafenib, what if they don't do well on sorafenib? Can we provide them with something else? And this was, for the first time, an opportunity to look into what we call a second-line therapy. And as you can see, just by simply providing those three different scenarios, you can imagine how much the community of research in primary liver cancer can be busy trying to address the many different questions that are addressed in those three major categories. Now, how do clinical trials work, and how a patient might or their loved one kind of help in making a decision to go on a clinical trial or not? Obviously, drugs are tested in the lab. There's plenty of information about. They come to the clinic to be tested first in patients, not necessarily with any specific disease, but rather to understand how they work in human beings. Will they be tolerated? What are the potential side effects? And try to kind of like figure out where they might work best and what kind of cancer. And accordingly, they move from that phase, which we call phase one, to what we call a phase two, where you try to kind of understand better a certain drug in a specific scenario or a specific disease, like, for example, primary liver cancer. And then you come to the big trials, which we call phase three, where now you are trying to understand specifically what a drug might do compared to what is the standard of care. And obviously, you can imagine now that we mentioned to you, and already you know, that sorafenib being the standard of care, most trials, at least in the first-line setting, will compare to that standard of care being sorafenib. So you might come to your doctor, and they might tell you, yes, you can go on sorafenib, or we have that certain clinical trial, and you might get sorafenib or that specific drug, sometimes always in randomized fashion, but sometimes without you knowing or your doctor what you will be getting, and sometimes you will never even be able to guess what you're getting. In certain scenarios, in the second-line setting, when, in other words, patients failed Nexavar and they are trying to get another therapy, and because there is no standard that is declared in that second-line setting, you might be asked to be randomized against a placebo. In other words, an inert drug that does not necessarily has any medical value versus the experimental drug. And this is, again, a technique used to be able to discern or find out if there is any value for that specific drug. Now, the general sense that we get from patients is people like to know what they're doing, and I totally agree. We all like to know what we're doing, and we like to kind of like get as much control of the situation as we can. And one of the challenges always is to kind of like understand, randomize the clinical trial specific, and what do they mean to the patient. The concept should be understood from that perspective. Number one is, if we knew better, and we know that there's a certain therapy that does work better than sorafenib, then of course it's done deal. We don't need that clinical trial. But really we don't. And as such, any patient in a situation where their disease would require as much therapy as we can give to be able to improve an outcome, having clinical trials available is really more of a strategic decision where you are enhancing on your options of therapy so you can really have more therapies available to you one after the other, so you can bridge from one to the other, so you can continue to live appropriately without any symptoms and benefit from that therapy if it is effective. The nervousness about when do you know and how do you know, it's something that always remind patients. Patients are seen, especially in clinical trial setting, on very frequent basis, for no reason except just to make sure that we are always clear about making sure they are doing okay, there is no symptoms, let the patient report to us any symptoms. And as such, really, doctors are so well geared to kind of like get a sense if patients are not benefiting or, God forbid, are not really doing well on a certain therapy, we're not committed to the trial, always we're committed to the patient and therapy will stop. In addition to that, the benchmark which we always kind of like are involved in, even though in general we read it in the clinic by seeing the patient, but nonetheless we get some imaging, being CAT scans or MRI, we really be able to declare what things are. And if things are not going well, patients can move on to another study or another therapy or what have we. And usually these kind of evaluations are set up in a platform where they're not delayed too much, but they're given a chance for the drug to work. And as such, really, in general, patients are not really put in any jeopardy for when this therapy might get evaluated and wouldn't miss necessarily on another opportunity that might be there. The same applies to the placebo component, because patients should read the placebo slash drug as being one entity, because they will never know. And usually the evaluations are close by. We are very well aware that this might nerve certain patients in regard to being on placebo. One of the techniques that's currently, for example, being acquired in many of the studies, we agree usually with the FDA, instead of randomizing patients 50-50, like tossing a coin to get placebo versus drug, we usually do a two-third, one-third. Two-third chance to get the drug, one-third to get the placebo. Again, a certain approach to kind of like, you know, ease up on our human nature of trying to know what we're doing. Bottom line is, the same way the Nexavar or the sorafenib that was approved, as Dr. Benson said, believe it or not, it was based on two placebo-controlled studies. In other words, certain patients, yes, did not get that therapy, but you can imagine the number of patients that are benefiting from that therapy right now. And be assured, when the data came out and people realized that actually there is a benefit for the sorafenib, patients who are on the placebo were actually unblinded and were offered therapy as well after a certain period of time. So always we care for the patients before anything else, and obviously there are certain rules and regulations that will kind of keep things in check when it comes to clinical trial. So it should never nerve you. If anything, it's always encouraged as a appropriate treatment option. Now, obviously, this is the kind of good extreme of what might happen to a patient. And as Dr. Benson mentioned, unfortunately, liver cancer is a very complex disease with a component of liver failure or cirrhosis that comes with it. And you can imagine that patients might have quite a bit of symptoms and certain signs that really could be concerning. And in some cases, unfortunately, it will be difficult to offer clinical trials to everybody in that setting, but rather try to kind of like make sure that patients are managed appropriately from the standpoint of making them sure they are comfortable, all their symptoms are addressed, and treated accordingly. What can a patient with liver cancer have as symptoms? No question, pain is a critical one. Patients are extremely encouraged to always talk about their pain, spell it out, state how intense it is, where it's location, what does make it better or not, how do they do on the medication for it, because I have to say that the number of pain medications and medications or procedures that can manage pain nowadays is really limitless, and always we will be able to find some appropriate approach that will make patients comfortable, pain-free, while still leading a certain appropriate life function. Other symptoms that can occur with liver failure, especially, unfortunately, patients sometimes will collect a lot of fluids in their abdomen or in their belly, in their legs. This is reflective of an increased buildup of pressure at the site of the liver or the core of the liver that will back up the fluids in those areas. And sometimes water pills, what we call diuretics, or sometimes a tap, like a certain needle that we insert in the belly to take fluid out, might be relieving to patients. Sadly, some patients might get jaundiced or yellow because of the liver function issues. It might cause itching. Some medications might control that itch. In rare instances in primary liver cancer, this could be fixed because of some blockage in the drainage of the bile, even though less likely. But nonetheless, this should be addressed when it is there. Patients, lastly, can be sometimes confused. Families are probably more to kind of like guess this. They might see patients spacing out, forgetful, kind of like sleepy during the day. They might kind of like be talking and they forget what they want to say. And these symptoms definitely need to be brought up to the physicians to be addressed. They might be related to the liver functionality and how it's doing. And there are, of course, medications that can take care of that as well. In addition to that, no question that quality of life, as you can see, will be critical. And it has to be understood not as a giving up or a passive approach, but rather another type of battle, another type of fight that's appropriate. Because sometimes, and especially in liver cancer, because of the limitation of the liver function, sometimes sadly, and it has been proven and shown in certain reports that giving therapy, if the liver function is so advanced, giving therapy to the liver cancer itself might hurt rather than help. While interestingly, managing the symptoms and making sure that patients are able to feel better, pain-free, without the distension in the abdomen, no itch or no confusion, will probably be more valuable and will probably imply an improvement in outcome compared to a certain therapy that's not necessarily determined to be safe in that specific setting per se. I think this is a kind of good roundup and hopefully a good introduction for Dr. Murphy as she addresses the other, the third part. And of course, I look forward to catch up with you in the question and answer session, and I pass it on to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Abu Alfa. Excellent presentation, very compassionate, just very really cutting edge in terms of the issues for people to think about in terms of their treatment and quality of life and symptom control. And thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Rachel Murphy. And Rachel is a dietitian. She is a senior clinical dietitian at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Murphy is going to address nutritional concerns and eating tips, which I know are very important issues for all of you on the call. So I'm going to turn this program over to Ms. Murphy.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Today I'd like to talk about nutrition goals for liver cancer, general nutrition recommendations for liver cancer, some symptoms and side effects, as well as some general guidelines for supplementation as well. So to start with, I'd like to talk about the nutrition goals for liver cancer, which are to prevent or reverse poor nutrition in order to maintain scheduled cancer treatments, to manage symptoms and side effects that can occur from the cancer itself, as well as cancer treatment, and also to maximize the quality of life. Now, in general, some nutrition recommendations for liver cancer are to potentially eat small but frequent meals throughout the day, trying to eat possibly every 2 to 3 hours during your waking hours to equal about 6 to 8 small meals per day. And these meals are not typical large meals like you're thinking of. They could be almost snack sizes. But this will provide your body with small bits of energy throughout the day. Try to plan your meals and snacks the day before if possible. For example, if you know you'll be away from home most of the next day for treatments and doctor's appointments, make sure to pack some calorie and protein-dense snacks to bring with you, like peanut butter and crackers or a protein bar. You want to make sure that you drink plenty of fluids. And a general rule of thumb for this is 8 to 10 8-ounce cups of fluid per day. Consume adequate amounts of protein, like beans, peas, poultry, which is chicken and turkey, meat, and dairy products if possible. Choose nutrient-dense foods like fruits, vegetables, and whole grains like multigrain breads, whole wheat pastas, things like that. And try to stay as active as you can. Unintentional weight loss is a common issue for people who have liver cancer. Weight loss is usually caused by an inadequate calorie intake. An inadequate calorie intake is usually caused by various symptoms of the cancer or the side effects of the treatment. And trying to treat the cause will usually help to increase the calorie intake automatically. Next, I'd like to move into some common symptoms and side effects that liver cancer patients usually experience, like poor appetite and early satiety, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, ascites, and encephalopathy. Now, if you're experiencing poor appetite or early satiety, which means getting full very quickly, try consuming small but frequent meals throughout the day, as I mentioned before. Try to avoid overly sweet foods or liquids, as well as greasy or fried or highly spiced foods as well. Maintain good oral care. And you can use liquid meal replacements like smoothies or supplement drinks as one of your small meals during the day. Now, if you're experiencing nausea with or without vomiting, try to eliminate offending odors if possible. Try room temperature or cooler foods because they tend to give off fewer odors. Try drinking liquids in a cup with a lid. Dry crackers or toast is usually tolerated pretty well, as well as sour or tart flavors. And lastly, use anti-nausea medication as prescribed by your doctor to adequately control the nausea. And if your nausea is adequately controlled, usually you're able to eat a little bit better. If you're experiencing diarrhea, you may want to limit or avoid the following: lactose, like milk and cheese, but usually yogurt and buttermilk are okay. Insoluble fiber, like wheat bran or whole grain products. Foods sweetened with sugar alcohol and sugar-sweetened beverages as well. If you're experiencing diarrhea, you may want to increase the following: foods with live, active culture yogurts, soluble fiber like oats, extra fluids in general to replace the losses from the diarrhea. And if you're vomiting with diarrhea, possibly high potassium and sodium foods or beverages to replace the loss of electrolytes as well. Now, if you're experiencing ascites, which is the buildup of fluid in the abdomen or belly, consuming smaller but more frequent meals throughout the day may help. And decreasing the sodium or salt in your diet to help decrease the fluid retention or the fluid buildup. If you're experiencing encephalopathy, which is impaired brain function due to the liver's inability to detoxify the body, this is generally treated with medication from your doctor, but know that a protein balance is important for maintaining lean body mass to keep your strength. So consume adequate amounts of protein daily, spreading the amount of protein consumed evenly throughout the day if possible. I last would like to briefly talk about guidelines for supplementation. First and foremost, you want to avoid mega doses of any vitamin or mineral supplement. But usually a daily standard over-the-counter multiple vitamin mineral supplement, as well as a calcium with vitamin D supplement, should be okay. But you can talk to your doctor about this to make sure they're okay with that as well. And finally, correcting any vitamin or mineral deficiencies under the care of a doctor or dietitian is important as well. But know that you can always meet with a dietitian for more personalized information, and you can talk to your doctor if you need help in finding one. That's all I have for today. Thank you for allowing me to be a part of the teleconference. I'll now pass the line back to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much. That's an excellent presentation, and thank you for being part of this call. Really a very important component, and the issues that you raised are so very important to all of our participants. So thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers, and we now have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions, so I'm going to ask Trinita to bring all of our speakers on board and to explain to the audience how to queue up and ask questions. And we're going to take as many of your questions as possible, and we'll do the very best we can. And if we don't get to your question, please do call Cancer Care at the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that again so that you'll be able to get your questions answered if we didn't get to them during the call. Trinita, if you could explain to everyone how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Again, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
And you also may ask questions online. Trinita, do you want to explain that as well?
You may submit your questions via the web. Simply type your question in the Ask a Question box and click Submit.
Thank you. We do have a question, actually, from one of our online participants. And that question really has to do with embolization in combination with sorafenib. Dr. Benson and Dr. Abu Alfa, could you address that question?
I'll be happy to answer that. That's a very good point. We kind of like focused in our discussion mainly on systemic therapies, as Dr. Benson introduced. But nonetheless, as we know, there are other forms of therapy for liver cancer. Just kind of give a little bit of platform. In general, a small amount of cancer in a good liver, probably surgery is the appropriate way to go. A small amount of cancer in a bad liver, probably a liver transplant, if available. Then, obviously, there is those patients with liver cancer embedded only in the liver but did not spread to the outside, where different forms of local therapy, among them the most commonly used is called embolization, would be appropriate. And then, obviously, there is patients with spread-out cancer that would require systemic therapy, as we discussed. To go back and describe embolization, the liver is actually a virtued organ because it has two blood supplies. It's kind of like having, you know, two supplies of water to your house. If one cuts off, you have still the other one. And interestingly, one of them is what we call the artery, which, as you know, is the clean blood. And this is one that actually cancer feed on usually. And we have the other one, which is the hepatic vein, which this is what kind of like brings to the liver the blood that already has circulated but needs to be cleaned up. In other words, if we imply or try to block the blood supply to the arterial supply where the tumors are feeding from, we still have the other source of blood, and thus the liver will still be okay. And now this technology has been so advanced that people can be quite selective in where do they apply it, block really the supply at limited areas rather than kind of have them expanded and be really kind of like very selective without injuring any liver per se. The story has been is can we make embolization better by adding something to it, like, for example, sorafenib. And there are certain biologic reasons to think this out, and as such, there has been certain clinical trials that try to evaluate the question. The last of which was simply reported almost just 2 weeks ago at one of our national meetings that happened in San Francisco that unfortunately did not show that adding the sorafenib to the embolization would be of value. There is still debate about if really this is addressed appropriately for certain technical reasons. And I know for sure that the group of Dr. Al Benson, actually the group that he's leading, still has another trial that is trying to address that question. And maybe this is a trial that we should support and patients should join on to try to find the answer to that. However, on the practical level, two important points are important here. Number one is, as I said, this is still within the realm of clinical trial, so it means should not be applied out of that setting. And number two, you might sometimes face a situation where you can hear an argument that if I handle or take care of the cancer in the liver, probably this is very important because this really was so critical, and I can very much support systemic disease or spread out disease or metastatic disease with the sorafenib at the same time. We are not really sure this is the right thing to do, because that kind of approach of trying to address the local disease with local therapy and addressing the systemic disease with systemic therapy in a combination is not proven. And the argument that you might hear, well, if anything is going to hurt the patient, it's the liver disease. We're not really sure this is true, and as such, we favor in that situation is still using systemic therapy rather than a combination of, for certain biologic reasons, as well as the lack of proof, as I mentioned. The other argument you might hear is, well, if you do an embolization, the tumor is going to look dark on the inside, it's going to die, it might show an improvement, and maybe it's more important than, for example, seeing a lung lesion that's really small, might not be contributing to the disease. It's very important to kind of like, of course, acknowledge that following the cancer by using CAT scans, by using MRI is very important. But I think as we kind of introduce the call and many of us refer to patients at the end of the day want to live longer and we want to make sure they live longer, that concept of improvement survival could be a little bit abstract and very difficult to sometimes entertain in a discussion about a certain local therapy. And you have to always ask your doctor, what will this offer me on the long run? Yes, I'll be satisfied to see this tumor look smaller or looks darker, but what does that mean to me survival-wise? This is really the question that could be sometimes hard to interpret or hard to read into because it's an abstract form of discussion, but nonetheless, try to pull this information wherever you can because these data are definitely available.
Excellent. Thank you. Dr. Benson, did you want to add anything?
I would just also like to emphasize Dr. Abu Alfa's point about the current clinical trial for chemoembolization and sorafenib as a combination approach. In the meeting, during the meeting in San Francisco, when the research team presented their initial results from a study of chemoembolization and sorafenib, this was a trial done outside the United States principally, their concluding remark was this really needs to be more definitively tested. And so there was a lot of support during this meeting that the United States effort here to look at the combination is very, very important. So many, many centers throughout the United States are participating in this program, so it is available to patients. Dr. Abu Alfa also has another trial also conducted by under the auspices of the National Cancer Institute, and both Dr. Abu Alfa and I participate in this cooperative group network program. He has a study where he's looking at one of the combination, a chemotherapy combination with sorafenib that's also trying to determine if a combination approach, albeit given a little differently than with the chemoembolization approach, will be helpful. So for us to take the next step forward in making advances for this disease, these type of trials will be increasingly important.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We have another question. Trinita?
Thank you. I'm showing we have a question from Jack N. Your question, please.
Yes. How effective is the radioembolization? I just had one about a month ago, and I would like to know how effective is that.
You just repeat your question, and Jack, just correct me if this is correct, that you've had one embolization, and you'd like to know how effective that is? Is that what your question is?
I think he had a radioembolization.
A radio. Oh,
is
okay.
That correct?
Right, it's correct.
Yes.
Okay. And
maybe Dr. Benson, you should answer that. You are the mecca of radioembolization.
Thank you.
So radioembolization is a technique that we've actually been using for some time. It is still under clinical trial investigation, including at Northwestern, where I'm located. But this technique also involves using a catheter that goes to the, as Dr. Abu Alfa mentioned, we target the arterial circulation of the liver because the tumors are dependent on the arterial circulation. But in this case, what we inject are really tiny microspheres that have been bombarded with very potent radiation. And these microspheres, when injected, go principally to the tumor areas. And these tumors tend to have a very, very rich blood supply. So these microspheres go throughout the tumor, and they release this very powerful radiation. One of the advantages, though, is that the radiation principally goes to the tumor area. It's a very small area for each microsphere where the radiation travels and affects the tumor. We have certainly noticed that this is a technique like chemoembolization that can help control liver tumors. These techniques have not really been compared in any meaningful way, so we cannot say that radioembolization is better than chemoembolization. We use both techniques. This is part of a multi-management, multidisciplinary team where we get together with our interventional radiologists to decide which technique we might use. Some people actually over time are treated with both techniques. But what I can say, it is a technique that has helped people. Most people need two treatments, one for the right lobe, one for the left lobe of the liver. But this is still a technique we're very interested in. We're still studying in clinical trials, and we hope to learn more and more information. But it has allowed us to expand our treatment opportunities for people.
Excellent. We have a question actually from one of our online participants. What kind of nutritional markers do you use for liver cancer patients?
I'm sorry, one more time. What markers?
What kind of nutritional markers do you use for liver cancer patients?
I mean, let me answer this from the oncologist standpoint, and maybe Dr. Murphy can answer from another perspective as well. Liver cancer is a very complex disease, as we mentioned, because truly it's not only a nutritional issue where patients are not necessarily eating, but the liver, because of the associated possible liver failure that can come with it, might consume or not being able to produce protein as a normal body does. So even if we tell a patient you need to eat a lot of proteins, it's not necessarily true that they will be able to make up for it, because sadly the liver also is not able to help them synthesize it per se. And as such, it's kind of like something that we monitor usually by looking at protein levels in the blood. We call them albumin usually, and this is one we look at, or this fraction of the proteins. And it kind of, you know, accommodates itself as one of the parameters that we evaluate, part of those scorings that Dr. Benson mentioned at the beginning, like the CHA-SPU score. The only challenge is that when patients eat proteins, they also, because not able to metabolize them correctly in the liver, they actually might back up in the body, and some of their outcome might be a little bit of confusion or spacing out or forgetfulness, same way I mentioned before, just because of that sluggishness in the liver. I want to make sure I'm very clear. This is not expected to happen on every patient. Most patients will not witness that. But patients with more advanced liver function, you might hear a little bit of contradicting information. Some doctor, like a hepatologist, will be worried and tell you ease up a little bit of proteins. And maybe an oncologist who is worried about your performance altogether will push you to eat more proteins, even though understanding you might be a little bit confused or spaced out on it. And there are medications to kind of avoid this from happening. I have to say it's a fine balance, that this is the beauty of medicine. Not everything is really prescribed in black and white, and every situation will have its own specifics. But nonetheless, yes, we do monitor for nutritional aspect. We see it from the perspective of intake. We see it also from the perspective of synthetic function. And of course, our job is to kind of like try to mediate between the two to make sure patients are doing okay.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Yes.
And I would add, I would agree with everything that Dr. Abulafa just said. I would also mention that we might also look at weight if fluid retention is not involved, because that can tell us if you're getting adequate calorie source. But if fluid retention, or if you're retaining fluid in the belly or the lower extremities and the feet and the ankles and the lower part of the leg, then weight is not a very good indicator. And then we will look kind of at, if there's any muscle wasting in the upper body, around the shoulders and the arms, things like that, to see if you're actually losing weight or lean body mass, but that fluid weight that's on there, if you're looking at the scale, is kind of keeping it even, or your weight is actually looking like it's increasing. So those are some other parameters that we might look at as well.
Excellent. Actually, I have a question from someone else here who, from an online participant who actually has, because of their anti-nausea steroid medication, has been gaining weight uncontrollably and is asking what they should do about it in terms of, and one of the questions that they had was, and it's for Rachel actually, is can they eat soy products? Rachel, could you, Ms. Bursey, could you address that?
Soy products should be okay. I mean, they're a good protein and carbohydrate source. If we're looking at it at a standpoint of depending on how much you're eating in conjunction with the rest of the food and the liquids that you're consuming, total calories is obviously going to be what you're wanting to look at as far as weight gain. I'm not sure if there's fluid retention involved or not, but soy products should be okay to consume in a moderate amount, absolutely.
And that's a good point you're raising in terms of the fluid retention, Dr. Benson and Dr. Abu Alpha, in terms of is this an issue that needs to be looked into for patients who appear to be gaining weight from, how is that addressed? Or
I have to say always I would love to see patients gaining weight, and obviously the steroids effect are to be handled exactly as Dr. Murphy said, but it's something frankly that will be much more kind of welcome and easier to handle than somebody, God forbid, who is really losing a tremendous amount of weight. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I re-stress exactly as Dr. Murphy said, we have to be very careful in regard to the potential for patients to gain weight, which is more of fluid or liquid accumulation in their belly, as I mentioned before, or in their legs, which is truly is a dry weight or not a protein or muscle mass weight, and it has to be kind of understood as not being a positive contributor, and patients should be aware, despite that it might be adding weight, it's not necessarily that they are really gaining actual muscle mass or weight per se.
Also, the fluid accumulation can be very uncomfortable for patients, and sometimes it is a challenge to adequately address such, but it is possible to help people with fluid accumulation, and that's part of the communication with the healthcare team to make sure that everyone understands what level of discomfort there is. There are people who have fluid accumulation, but it doesn't affect their activity and they feel well, whereas there are others who are very uncomfortable from excessive fluid. So there is a great deal of variation, but it should be addressed with the healthcare team.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers who've been outstanding. I also want to thank all of you who've asked really such great questions, both either on the telephone or online, that this has been an extraordinary call. And I want to remind all of you this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we do recognize that you have so many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I just would like to review with you all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Cancer Care has a staff of 45 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services from practical and financial assistance to support and someone to talk to, counseling. We offer support groups on the telephone and online, and we also have a lot of these education workshops as well as materials, fact sheets, and booklets. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you are alone in coping with liver cancer or in coping with cancer in general. I want you to now feel you're part of a community of support, and we really are here to help you. You can call us. We're simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.